which ceased in 1979 when the Shah of Iran was put off his throne, the oldest reigning imperial regime in the world. Well, in any case, Cyrus, the Shahanshah, forged this great unity between the Medes and the Persians and formed a temporary alliance with the Neo-Babylonians that had as its first goal, as its first aim, sort of putting an end to the Assyrian menace. In a certain sense here, this was probably, we may say, from the standpoint of the Medes and the Persians, a preemptive strike. The Assyrians had not conquered Persia, but there was always the great fear that they might do so. So in a sense, the Medes and the Persians finally say, it's in our interest to get rid of these guys. And that's basically what happened then to the Assyrians. Now, very quickly, the Persians, who were at a much higher level culturally, who were at a much higher level economically, who had much more sophisticated political organization, became the dominant partner in the Mede-Persian fusion. Now, the Medes and Persians, or as we'll call them from now on, the Persians, then began themselves a series of lightning military campaigns. These campaigns went east, virtually to the frontiers of China. These campaigns went southeast, virtually to the frontiers of India. And these campaigns went west. They went to the Mediterranean Sea, overrunning the eastern shore of the Mediterranean. They went to the west into Egypt and overran Egypt and small portions of the coast of North Africa, even to the west of Egypt. And they conquered virtually all of Anatolia, all of what we would think of as Turkey, including its Mediterranean coastland, where, I'll just mention, large numbers of Greeks lived. In a later lecture, we're going to bump into these Persians as the Persians and the Greeks were bumping into each other. But the point for now is simply to say that the Persians built, in a series of remarkably fast campaigns, the biggest empire that had ever been built anywhere up until that time. And indeed, one of the largest, really, that has ever been built. How did they do it? Well, there's a number of reasons, I think, for the Persian success. Again, like the Assyrians, they had a very large army. The Persian army, we think from later reports, may have numbered on a regular basis as many as 300,000 men. Now, the Greek historian Herodotus tells us when the Persians invaded Greece that they had an army of 1 million men. Well, first of all, that number is suspiciously round. I mean, it might have been 997,326. But probably the number is way too big. But even an army of 300,000 men. Stop and think now. In a modern society, of the cost and all of the administrative problems that would be associated with maintaining 300,000 men. War may strike us as something unpleasant, as something unthinkable even, but war is one of the most sophisticated things any society can do. And maintaining a military establishment is one of the most complicated things that any society can do. In some very real ways, to peer into a society and figure out how it works, ask questions about its military establishment. And you'll learn a very great deal about that society. So the Persians had a very large army, which at least in antiquity was imagined to be as large as 300,000 men. There was also inside that army a quite interesting group, the 10,000 immortals. Now they weren't immortal in the sense that they didn't die. They were immortal in the sense that if one of them fell in battle, another immediately came up to take his place. So that central core of the army always stayed at, in tradition, 10,000 men. They also had the responsibility of guarding the Shah, of guarding the emperor, guarding the king, of protecting him. And indeed, Persian rulers did not fall on the battlefield, but they did appear on the battlefield. They didn't sort of sit way far away and watch what was going on. So a very large army, one thing. The second place, brilliant cavalry tactics. The Persians, as I mentioned a moment ago in connection with the Assyrians, who understood how to use cavalry to get someplace fast, it was the Persians who figured out what to do with men on horses once you got there. Now, on any given battlefield, the challenge for those fighting is either to outflank the enemy or to avoid being outflanked by the enemy. Two long, relatively stable lines slugging it out with each other will create a lot of mayhem and destruction. And at the end of the day, think of the trench warfare in World War I, you may have moved forward a few yards or fallen back a few yards, but not much will have changed. What the Persians discovered is that once the main bodies of infantry had engaged, if you used cavalry at just the right moment, in just the right numbers, you could turn your enemy's flank. And this then would produce the rout This then produces an enemy who is not surrounded, but who's being attacked on two sides simultaneously. So in that sense, some aspects of military strategy from antiquity persist right down to modern times. Now, there were other reasons for Persian success, too. I don't want to put all of the stress on the Persian military establishment. The Persians were very tolerant of the customs of local peoples. They often left local people in charge. Now, the basic local officer of the Persian administration was called a satrap. The Persians built a very sophisticated and complicated administrative structure. It all culminated in the Shah. It culminated in the emperor. And then there were these officials at the local level called satraps. Now, under the satraps, there were various minor and subordinate officials. And then, interestingly enough, above the satraps, there were officials called the eyes and ears of the king. They were, in effect, state spies. And they were sent out to kind of observe.